And now, for our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist, narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Mort Shelby, Karen Carbone, Colleen Delaney, Nanette Savard, M.B. Van Dorn, Richard Rowan, Ken Jackson, David Coyne, James Lewis, Michael Glenn, Kate Torrey, and James Konacek. The Survivalist Number 2, The Nightmare Begins. General Ishmael Barakov buttoned the collar of his greatcoat and pulled the sealskin chopka down lower on his balding head.
Chicago. I'm over Moscow. Bah!
Behind him, a sea of mud that stretched to meet the icy, wind-tossed Lake Michigan waters beyond. Ahead, a massive edifice stood less than 25 yards distant. He didn't bother to look for the name. It had been the Museum of Natural History, given to the city of Chicago for a World's Fair decades earlier, and bearing the name of a capitalist, as far as Barakov could recall. The planetarium, less than a quarter mile away, had been badly damaged, but the museum, soon to be Soviet headquarters, was barely touched. The brunt of the force of the Seiche that had swamped much of the city, destroying everything in its path like a tidal wave, had hit the northern shoreline. The houses and apartments of the rich capitalists had been there, and were now in ruins. Barakov did not smile at the thought. The rich, too, had a right to life.
Put up a new name, one that should reflect that this is headquarters for the North American Army of Occupation of the Soviet People's Republic. You can make a note of this when your hands stop trembling with the wind.
Comrade General Barakov.
What is it, Major?
General, our forces have captured 17 armed partisans. 14 men and 3 women. They killed 12 of our men before we were able to pacify them.
They survived the neutron radiation?
We believe they took shelter underground when Chicago was bombed, General. They have been armed with American sporting guns. If you wish to see...
I will come, Major.
Up ahead, sir.
Some of them are nothing more than children.
Yes, Comrade General. I wouldn't have expected that such a ragtag bunch would put up such a fight. You can be the one to give the order to fire if you wish, General.
No. No, they are your prisoners. It is your honor.
Yes, sir. Men! Ready! Aim! Fire! Soldier! Finish that one over there!
Yes, comrade!
Very good, Comrade Major.
Barakov wiggled his toes in his white boot socks under the massive leather-covered desk at the far end of the central hall. He looked up for what must have been, he felt, the 100th time at the Egyptian murals on the upper walls. It was dark in the cavernous space. They would need to bring lights in before anyone would be able to get any work done. He looked back to the reports littering his desk. Barakov glanced at the Swiss movement watch on his left wrist. There were 10 minutes remaining before the intelligence meeting. He hated intelligence meetings because he resented, distrusted, and, secretly, feared and despised the vast power of the KGB. He recalled the mysterious crash of a plane carrying top-level Soviet naval officers not long before the war had begun, if it had been nothing more than a crash. Barakov looked down to his open uniform blouse and stocking feet and shrugged his shoulders. As commanding general, he had some advantages, he reflected. There were long, low, winding stairs at the rear of the hall leading up to the mezzanine that overlooked the central hall, and he took these slowly under his ponderous overweight, clinging to the rail as he scaled to the top. From the mezzanine rail, he surveyed a massive, life-size sculpture dominating the center of the hall, 2 mastodons fighting to the death. A smile lifted the corner of Varakov's sagging cheeks. One of the mastodons appeared to be winning the struggle for supremacy. But to what avail? Mastodon as a species was now extinct, vanished forever from the Earth. I've been meaning to ask you, Rourke. Out of all those bikes back there at the crash site, why did you take that particular one?
A couple of reasons. I like Harley Davidsons. I already have a lowrider like this back at my survival retreat. It's about the best combination going for off-road and road use. Good enough on gas, fast, handles well, lets you ride comfortably. I just like it, I guess, Paul.
You got reasons for everything, haven't you, John?
Yeah, I usually do. And I've got a very good reason why we should check out that truck trailer down there. You see it?
Where?
Down there. That dark shape on the side of the road. I'll show you when we get there.
Whoa!
You gotta watch those hills, pal.
Tell me about it. But I'm starting to get the hang of it.
All right, you are. You're still not great, though. Luckily for you, there's nothing between us and that truck except paved road. Let's go check it out.
Rourke pointed his motorcycle in the direction of his gaze. The sun was just below its zenith, and as far as Rourke was able to tell, they were already into Texas and perhaps 75 miles or less from El Paso. The heat was oppressive, but the dry wind still had some cooling effect on his skin. Already he could feel his shirt, sticking to his back with sweat, starting to dry. He glanced into his rearview mirror and could see Paul Rubenstein trying to catch up. Rourke smiled. As he zeroed toward the ever-growing dark spot ahead of them on the highway, his mind flashed back to the beginning of the curious partnership between himself and the younger man. Though trained as a physician, Rourke had never practiced. After several years with the CIA in Latin American covert operations, his interests in weapons and survival skills had qualified him as an expert. He wrote and taught on the subject around the world. Rubenstein had been a junior editor with a trade magazine publisher in New York City. He was an expert on pipe fittings and punctuation marks. But they had two important things in common. They had both survived the crash of the rerouted 747 that Rourke had been taking to Atlanta in order to rejoin his wife and children in northeastern Georgia. That night of the thermonuclear war with Russia had seemingly gone on forever. And now, Rourke and Rubenstein shared another bond here in the West Texas desert. Both men had to reach the Atlantic Southeast. For Paul Rubenstein, there was the chance that his aged parents might still be alive, that St. Petersburg, Florida had not been a Soviet target, and that the violence after the war had not claimed them. For Rourke, there was the hope that his wife and two children were alive. The farm where they had lived in northeast Georgia would have survived the bombs that had fallen on Atlanta. But the aftermath held the almost insurmountable threats of radiation poisoning, food shortages, and murderous roving gangs. Rourke could only wish that his wife, Sarah, would have allowed him to teach her some of the skills that now might enable her to stay alive.
It's a common carrier, abandoned. After we run the Geiger counter over it, we can check what's inside. Might be something useful. Shut off your bike. I don't think we're going to find any gas here.
Radiation count looks all right.
Good. Damn it, it's locked.
You going to shoot it off?
You've gotten awful violent lately, haven't you? We got a pry bar?
Nothing big.
Well, then I guess I'm going to shoot it off. Get back. Be careful, the lock might be...
Ouch!
Hot. From the friction. Get a rock and knock it off. Now open it. You gotta work that bar lock. Here, watch.
Just boxes.
It's what's in them that counts. We could stand a resupply.
But isn't that stealing, John?
A few days ago before the war, it was stealing. Now, it's foraging. There's a difference.
What do you want to forage?
Well, this might be nice. 45 ACP ammo. It's even my brand and bullet weight. 185 grain JHPs.
Ammunition?
Yeah. Jobbers or wholesalers use certain common carriers to ship firearms and ammunition to dealers. I'd hoped we'd find some of this. Find yourself some 9mm Parabellum. May as well stick to solid so you can use it in that MP40 as well as the Browning high power you're carrying. If you come across any guns, let me know.
Why don't we take all of this stuff? All the ammo, I mean.
How are we going to carry it? I can use 308, 223, 45 ACP, and 357, and that's too much. I've got ample supplies of ammunition back at the retreat once we get there.
That's still close to 1,500 miles, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hey, John, you want some spare clips? Magazines for your rifle? 30-round AR-15?
Are they actual Colt? Look on the bottom on the floor plate.
Yeah, they are.
Take them along, then.
You sure this isn't dishonest?
This is war, Paul. A few nights ago, the United States and the Soviet Union had a major nuclear exchange. The United States apparently didn't fare so well. Every place we flew over before the 747 crashed looked hit. The whole Mississippi River area seems to have been saturated. According to the Arizona kid I got on the radio before we crashed, the San Andreas fault line slipped and everything north of San Diego washed into the sea, and the tidal waves flooded as far in as Arizona. There were even quakes there. Albuquerque was abandoned after the firestorm, except for the injured and dying and the wild dogs. You'll remember them. We shot it out with that gang of renegade bikers who butchered the people we'd left back at the plane while we were trying to get help. Now, how would you evaluate all that?
No civil authority, no government, every man for himself. No law at all.
You're wrong there. There is law. There's always moral law. But we're not violating that by taking things here that we need in order to survive out there. And the obligation we have is to stay alive. You want to see if your parents made it? I want to find Sarah and the children. So we owe it to ourselves and them to stay alive. Now go see if you can find something to use as a sack to carry all this stuff. I'm going to take some of this baby food here. It's full of protein and sugar and vitamins.
I had a little nephew back in New York. Anyway, that stuff tastes terrible.
But it can keep us alive.
John, New York is gone, isn't it? My nephew, his parents, I had a girlfriend. We weren't serious, but we might have gotten serious. But it's gone, isn't it?
I don't know. You want an educated guess? I'd say, yeah, New York is gone. I'm sorry, Paul, but it was probably quick. They couldn't have even tried to evacuate.
I know. I've been thinking about that. I used to buy a paper from a little guy down on the corner. He was a Russian immigrant. Came here to escape the mess after the Russian Revolution. He was just a little boy then. He was always so concerned with his manliness. I remember in the wintertime, he never pulled his hat down over his ears, and they were red and peeling. His cheeks were that way. I used to say to him, "Max, why don't you protect your face and ears? You're going to get frostbite." But he'd just smile and not say anything. I guess he's dead too, huh?
I guess he is, Paul.
Yeah, I guess. Rourke searched the remaining boxes quickly. He found some flashlight batteries, bar-type shaving soap, pre-packed in small mugs, and safety razors and blades. He found another consignment of ammunition, 158-grain semi-jacketed soft-point 357s, and took 8 boxes of 50. With it were some 223 solids, and he took several hundred rounds of these as well. He carried what he wanted in 2 boxes back to the rear of the trailer and helped Rubenstein pack it in a sack to carry. They climbed back out into the open air.
We're going to have to split up this load if we want to...
John!
Caught you boys with your fingers in the pie, didn't we?
That's a damn stupid remark.
You men are under arrest.
By who?
I'm Captain Nelson Pinchum of the Texas Independent Paramilitary Response Group.
Oh, I see. The T-I-P-R-G. Tiprig. That sounds pretty stupid, Captain.
We'll see how stupid it sounds when you boys get shot in just about a half a second. Official policy is to shoot looters on sight. Isn't that right, boys?
That's the official policy, is it? And whose official policy would that be? Yours?
It's the official policy of the Paramilitary Provisional Government of Texas.
Try saying that with a couple of beers under your belt.
Drop that sidearm. That big hog leg on the belt around your waist. Move, boy. Now, the guns from the shoulder holsters. Quick. Hold it. Go get those pistols, trooper. Move out.
You're just gonna shoot us? You sure you don't want to talk about this?
Oh, I'm sure.
Now, mister. Just reach under your armpits there, nice and slow. The right hand gets the one under the right arm, the left hand the left one. Nice and easy. Then stick him out in front of you, with the pistol butts toward me.
Right. To get them out of the holsters, I've got to jerk them a little bit.
You just watch how you do it, mister. No funny stuff. Me and Mr. Heckler here will cut you in half where you stand.
Soldier?
That's a good boy.
Here you go.
Huh?
Out of the corner of his eye, Rourke could see Rubenstein, almost as if in slow motion, grab up the assault rifle from the man nearest him, whom Rourke had shot down. Paul now had the muzzle of the weapon flush against Pincham's right cheekbone. Hold your fire or Pincham gets it!
It's your show now, Paul.
Now, everybody get out from cover and throw your rifles to the ground. Move it!
Do as I say. Hurry!
Gun belts, too.
All right. You guys want to be military? Get into the front-leaning rest position. Like a push-up position with arms straight. Do it now! First man moves, dies.
What do we do now, John?
You want to kill him?
What?
I don't especially feel like it either. Why don't you get the bike straight, and in a minute here, we can take these fellows for a walk a few miles down the road. Then let them go. I'll keep them covered.
I'll divide up the loads.
So, Pincham, you guys got any vehicles around here? How about it, Pincham?
Yeah, on both sides of the road.
Any gas cans?
Yeah.
Much obliged. Paul, go over there and get some gas for the bikes. Take that thing you call a Schmeisser in case they left someone on guard. Did you leave anyone on guard?
No, nobody on guard.
Good. If anything happens to my friend, you get an extra nostril.
Nobody on guard.
Okay, Rourke, we're ready to roll. Can we get up, please?
No.
Barbarian.
No, I just want them good and tired so they can't get back here fast enough to follow us. It's either that, or we disable your vehicles. And I don't think you'd like being stranded out here in the desert on foot, right? All right, Captain. Order your men onto their feet, get them walking ahead of us. You bring up the rear. Anyone tries anything, it's your problem.
Get up! All of you! If I ever catch sight of you, you're a dead man.
Oh yeah! There's some great baby food back there in the truck in case you fellas get hungry. Let's go, Paul.
Hey, John. I saw that trick in a Western movie once. The pistol spinning, I mean.
Yeah?
What do they call that? When you roll the guns like that when someone tries to take them?
I don't know. The road agent spin? Yeah, I like that.
I understand your prerogative as KGB men is to focus on the elimination of political undesirables, but...
Comrade, what Moscow wants is a system of transition.
Moscow wants me to run this country, to keep armed rebellion from getting out of hand, and to get the heavy industry restarted. Some resistance cannot be avoided in a nation where everyone owns a gun. How I choose to accomplish my task is my concern. If Moscow eventually decides I am not doing my job properly, then they will be replaced. This will not be a fiefdom of the KGB. Intelligence is to serve the interests of the Soviet people and the government. The government and the people are not holding their breath to serve the interest of intelligence. The Soviet is facing famine, a shortage of raw materials, and most of our heavy industry has been destroyed by American missiles. If we cannot get this new land we have acquired to be productive, we shall all starve. Have no more ammunition for our guns, have no spare parts. Most of American heavy industry is intact. Most of ours is gone. Our primary responsibility is to man the factories with work battalions and develop productivity. Otherwise, all is lost. What do you think, Captain Timarovna?
Comrade General, I realize the importance of the tasks you have enumerated. But in order to successfully reactivate industry here, we must be secure against sabotage and organized subversion. Comrade Major Karamazov, I am sure, only wishes to begin working to eliminate potential subversives from the muster list in order to speed up your goals, Comrade General.
You should have been a diplomat, Natalia. It is Natalia, is it not?
Yes, Comrade General.
There is one small matter before we get to your master list of persons for liquidation. It is not an intelligence matter, but I wish your collective input. The bodies. In the neutron bombed areas, such as Chicago, there are rotting corpses everywhere. Wild dogs and cats have come in from the areas that were not bombed. Rats are becoming a problem. A serious problem. Public health, comrades. Any suggestions? I cannot have you arrest and liquidate rats, bacteria, and wolf-like hounds.
There are many natives in the ineffective suburban areas around the city, and it would be possible...
I knew somehow, Comrade Major, that you would have a plan.
We can send troops into these areas to form these people into work battalions, designating central areas for the burning of corpses, and equipping some of these work battalions with chemical agents to destroy the rats and bacteria.
But Vladimir... But, Comrade Major, for such chemicals to be effective, they must be of sufficient strength. Those persons in the work battalions could be adversely affected by them.
Precautions will, of course, be taken. But there will be adequate replacements for those who become careless, Captain Tiemerovna. Once these work battalions have completed their task, they can be organized into factory labor. If they are utilized in 12-hour shifts, working through the night, the electrification system is still largely intact, the city can be reclaimed within days, or a week at the most. I can have the exact figures for you within the hour, Comrade General.
I do not think your figures will be necessary, but your plan seems to be the most viable.
Thank you, Comrade General. But providing figures will be of no difficulty. I had anticipated that this problem might be of concern to you, and have already had them prepared. Pending, of course, the actual number of survivors available for the work battalions and the quantities of chemical equipment that can be secured for the program, I can easily obtain these additional figures as well, should you so desire.
I am not ready to retire yet, my ambitious young friend.
I assure you, Comrade General, that I have
nothing is assured, Karamazov. But now, tell me about your list.
We must protect the safety of the state at all costs, comrades. And of course, it is for this reason that many years ago, before the close of World War II, my predecessors began the compilation of a list, constantly updated, of persons who, in the event of war with the capitalist superpowers, would be potential troublemakers, rallying points for resistance, etc. The master list, as it came to be called, has, as I indicated, been constantly updated. It was impossible to predict with any acceptable degree of accuracy who might survive such a war and who might not. And to determine which targets would be most readily able to be eliminated in any event. For this reason, since its inception, the master list was broken into broad categories of persons, all of equal value for elimination purposes.
These are names we might recognize?
Oh yes, Comrade General. Many of these names are important public officials, yet many of the other names are not so easily recognized, except to us.
Give to me some examples of this, Major.
Well, they are from all areas of life. In the Alpha section, for example, one of the most important names is Samuel Chambers. This Chambers person, to the best of our knowledge, is the only surviving member of the presidential cabinet. He was the minister, secretary, that is, of communications. According to our interpretation of the American Constitution, he is, in fact, whether he knows it or not, the President of the United States at this moment. He must be eliminated. Chambers is an excellent example. He was in the Beta section until his elevation to the Alpha section, corresponding with his elevation to the Presidential Advisory Cabinet. He has always been ardently opposed to our country. An anti-communist, he calls himself. He has always had a great popular support because of this position. He owns several radio and television broadcasting stations, had a radio program broadcast on independently owned radio stations around the country for several years. His name was a household word, as the Americanism goes.
Then we do not wish to negotiate formal surrender with him.
Under normal circumstances, yes, Comrade General, we would. But this Chambers would never agree. And if we forced his signing of a conciliatory statement, the people here would never accept its validity. His only value is as a dead man. In his very utility as a symbol of American anti-communist feeling, his death would be but another blow to American resistance, showing them how useless such activity is, how counterproductive.
Give me still another example, Vladimir.
I have no inclination that the next man is still alive. He was a writer living in the American Southeast. Adventure novels about American terrorists fighting communist agents from the Soviet Union and other countries. He wrote often as well in magazines devoted to sporting firearms. Several times he openly condemned our system of government in print, in national periodicals here. He attempted to exalt individualism and subvert the purposes of social order through his articles and his books. His name, I do not recall at this point in time. He would be on a low priority list, but nonetheless, his liquidation would be necessary. Still another example would be retired Central Intelligence Agency personnel who remained provisionally active. Reserve officers in the armed forces would be still another list. There are many thousands of names, Comrade General Varakov, and work must be begun immediately to locate and liquidate these persons as potential subversives.
Purge?
Yes, but a purge for the ultimate furthering of the collective purposes of the heroic Soviet people, Comrade General.
I will sign this order. But since individual execution orders would not be necessary, I will have it amended to read that only such persons as currently are named on the master list can be liquidated without express written order, signed by myself. I do not wish to initiate a bloodbath, Vladimir. Make no mistake. I will not be so foolish as to sign a blanket order that could someday be turned into my own death warrant, comrade.
Why are we stopping, John?
We're about 8 or 10 minutes out of El Paso. Doesn't look like it was hit, but that wasn't what you might call the gentlest town in the world before the wars, I remember. Juarez is right across the bridge from it, over the Rio Grande.
We going into Mexico?
No, not unless I can't avoid it. Those paramilitary troops we locked horns with were bad enough to worry about, and they're on our tail by now again. Probably had a radio, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think they did.
Well, we might have a reception waiting for us up ahead. But in Mexico, we could have federal troops on our tails. They do their number a hell of a lot better. With the guns and the bikes and whatever other equipment somebody might imagine we had, we'd have everybody and his brother trying to knock us off to get it. I don't know if Mexico got caught up in the war or not, but things might be awful rough down there.
Well, maybe we should skip El Paso entirely.
Yeah, I thought of that. I thought about that a lot on the road the last few miles, but I haven't seen any game since we started. Have you?
No, me neither.
And that baby food I snatched isn't going to make more than a day's rations for both of us. And you're right, it does taste kind of pukey. We need food, we're almost out of water, and we could use some more gasoline. I wouldn't mind scrounging some medical instruments if I could find them either. I got all that stuff at the retreat, but it's a long way getting there still.
You never told me. Why do you have the retreat? I mean, did you know this war was going to happen or what?
No, I didn't know it. See, I went through medical school, interned and everything. I'd always been interested in history, current events, things like that. I guess I figured that instead of training to cure people's problems, maybe I could prevent them. That didn't work out, though. I joined the CIA, spent some years there, mostly in Latin America. I was always good with guns. I liked the out-of-doors. Some experiences I had with the company sort of sharpened my skills that way. I married Sarah just before I got out. I was already writing about survival and weapons training, things like that. I settled down to writing and started the retreat. The more friction that developed between us, the more time and energy I poured into the retreat. I've got a couple years' worth of food and other supplies there, and the facilities to grow more food, make my own ammo. The water supply is abundant, too. I even get my electricity from it. All the comforts
of home.
Well, it will be, once I find Sarah, Michael, and Anne.
How old is Michael again?
Michael's 9. Little Annie just turned 6. Sarah's 32. That picture I showed you of Sarah and the kids is kind of off, but it was a kind of happy time when I took it, so I held on to it.
She's an artist?
Yeah. Illustrates children's books, then started writing them, too, a couple of years ago. She's very good at it.
I always wanted to try my hand at being an artist. So, what do you think we'll run into in El Paso?
Something unpleasant, I'm sure. I'd keep that MP40 of yours close.
I guess I better. Hey, John?
Yeah?
I did okay back there, didn't I? I mean, with those paramilitary guys?
You did just fine.
I mean, I'm not just hanging on with you, am I?
If you were, Paul, I'd tell you.
Sarah Rourke reined back on Tildy, her chestnut mare, pulling up short behind Carla Jenkins's bay. Sarah watched Carla closely, as well as the little girl Millie astride behind her. The way Sarah saw it, Carla handled a horse like she handled a shopping cart. She was dangerous with either one. Leaning over in the saddle, Sarah glanced past Carla to Carla's husband, Ron, the retired army sergeant to whom she had temporarily entrusted her fate and the fate of her children, Michael and Anne. She looked back over her shoulder at her children, sitting astride her husband, John's horse. The big off-white mare with the black stockings, mane, and tail was named Sam, and she reached back and stroked Sam's muzzle now.
How are you guys doing? Isn't it fun riding Daddy's horse?
Dad's saddle's too big, Mom.
I want to ride with you, Mommy. I don't like riding on Sam. She's not soft.
You can ride with me later, Annie. Now just be good and stay right here. I'm going to ride up and find out why Mr. Jenkins stopped. What's the problem, Ron?
Another town, Sarah. Down there.
Hearing Ron Jenkins call her by her first name still sounded odd to Sarah, but she reminded herself she had never called him Ron until a few days ago when he and his wife and daughter had come to the farm and asked if she wanted to accompany them. They moved slowly, the Jenkins family, and Ron Jenkins had meticulously avoided every possible small town between them and the mountains he kept referring to. But they were already in the mountains, she realized, and she wondered if Jenkins's enigmatic references had been to the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee rather than the mountains of northwestern Georgia. Leaning back in the saddle, trying to press her spine against the cantle to relieve the aching, she realized that if Jenkins intended to take them out of Georgia, she would not go. On the chance that her husband John was still alive, chances would be slimmer of his finding them if they left the state and the area around the farm. She knew that her husband's survival retreat was in these mountains somewhere, so if they stayed here, it would only be a matter of time until the family was reunited. But the farther Jenkins took her away from the northeast Georgia farm that she and the children had called home before the night of the war, the slimmer the chances would be. They had viewed some towns from a distance, and many had looked as though they had been looted and burned. Once, several hours back, they had hidden quietly as a gang of what Sarah called brigands on motorcycles and driving pickup trucks had come down a road that the two families had been about to cross. Sarah's mind flashed back to the night of the war and to the morning after and the gunfight when she had killed the men and the woman who had tried to harm her and the children. Her eyes drifted to the much-modified AR-15 rifle she had taken from one of the dead men. Her husband's Colt 45 was still in the trouser band of her Levi's, rubbing against her flesh, and it hurt. She shifted it slightly as she shifted her weight in the saddle. It was already nearly dusk, and she couldn't see clearly at first in the shadow-enclosed valley below them, but after a moment, as her eyes became more accustomed to the dimness, she could make out the scene unfolding there. It was the gang they had seen several hours earlier. The faces were strange when she had seen them from quite close then, but even discounting that, she had known they were not from the area. People in Georgia were, by and large, good-natured, gentle people. As a northerner in a strange part of the country, she had learned that years earlier. And these men and women in the small town below them were not gentle. Some of the old frame houses on both ends of the main street were already afire. The bulk of the gang was in the center of the town. Looking down into the shallow valley, she was too far away to make out individual actions, but she could see them moving like large ants from store to store in the small business district.
Those people were fools to stay in their town.
So, can we do something?
Well, I'm no weapons expert like your husband was.
Is Mr. Jenkins?
I doubt that, Mrs. Rourke. I think he bought it during the war. But I ain't like him, whether he's alive or dead. I'm just an army veteran trying to get along. I'd can handle a gun as good as the next man, but I'm not about to go racing on down there and be a hero, because all I'll be is dead. Then my wife and daughter and your kids is going to be just on your own. And that ain't right. I got a responsibility to my family, and to your family too now, and I take that pretty serious.
I'm sorry. You're right, I guess. What are we going to do then?
I think we're just going to sit tight up here and see which way those folks decide to go after they finish their business down there. Then we'll move out in the opposite direction. Carla's got a sister up in the Smokies there around Mount Eagle, and I reckon that should be a pretty safe place to go.
That's in Tennessee, Mr. Jenkins. I can't go there.
Now listen, Mrs. Rourke. I don't know what's hiding there in the back of your head, ma'am, but you just can't sit out here in the mountains and wait for your husband John to appear out of nowhere and rescue you. You got your family to look out for, same as I got mine. Now, once things calm down a bit and everything gets settled, you can always look for your husband then. But if you decide on staying in these mountains with the likes of them down there, you ain't gonna last a day. Now, that's a pure fact.
My husband won't find us in Tennessee.
Your husband is dead, Mrs. Rourke, and I wish for your own sake you'd wake up and see that.
John is alive. I've been telling that to my children, and I believe it myself. He spent his whole life learning how to stay alive, and I know he did, somehow. And I know that somewhere now, wherever he is, he's thinking about me and about Michael and Annie, and risking everything to get back here to us. And I'm not going to betray him and run out. I'm not going to Tennessee with you, or anyone else.
After 2.5 hours, Ron Jenkins no longer heard the sound of engines and chaos from the valley below.
Listen. Sounds like it's quieted some down there. I'm gonna head into that town there to see what supplies I can find.
What? You can't leave us, Ron!
I'm gonna have to. Now, you just wait here. I'll be back in a little while. I won't need my horse. You keep it close by and saddled and ready. I figure they might have some water and some other things down there. I reckon we could use them just as soon as leaving them down there to rot.
Ron, please! Please don't leave us here!
I think Carla's right, Ron. Shouldn't we all stick together? Those men could still be in the area.
Just wait here and be ready to move out when I get back.
As the third hour of waiting for the return of Ron Jenkins crept to a close, Sarah Rourke sat taking stock of her situation. One thing she had learned about Jenkins was that once he made up his mind, he wouldn't change it. She remembered her own husband being like that. She saw the same trait in herself, and now, since the night of the war and her experiences the following morning, she felt that perhaps she should have changed her mind. She had hated the guns he kept and practically called him a fool for building and stocking his survival retreat. Yet guns had kept her alive so far, and now the survival retreat she had loathed the thought of seemed to her a sort of haven of normalcy as she sat there in the dark, huddled with the children's heads in her lap. They couldn't build a fire, the gang in the valley having left the town only a few hours earlier and still perhaps close enough to see a fire and come to investigate. She couldn't sleep, though she was tired. Her body was beyond sleep. She watched Carla Jenkins, who sat silent as the grave, with her daughter Millie's head cradled on her lap. She sat less than a yard away from Sarah, just sat staring out into the darkness. A shiver shot up Sarah Rourke's spine. She recognized the sound, having heard it too often in the hospital emergency room where she volunteered. That had been the place she'd first met John. At the time, she'd thought little beyond the fact that his lean face and high forehead and dark eyes and hair looked attractive and that he had apparently noticed her, too. Years later, when their lives had crossed again, they had dated, talked a lot, and eventually married. It had taken both of them some time to recall the chance meeting years earlier. They had laughed about it.
Oh, God!
I think one of us should go and see, Carla.
I can't!
I can go.
No, you mustn't. Ron will be back soon.
Someone is screaming down there, Carla. It might be that something has happened.
No, he is just fine. Now you let things be.
Carla, you're being a fool. Your husband's in trouble down there. The brigands must have come back. They're killing him. I'm going.
I don't want you to.
I'm trusting you to watch Michael and Annie, Carla. I have to. Michael, I need you to wake up.
No, I wasn't asleep.
Are you awake?
Yes.
All right. I'm going down into the valley to see if Mr. Jenkins is all right. I don't want to wake up Annie, but if she does wake up, keep her very still. If she makes any noise, those bad men who burned the town down there could find us. Do you understand me, Michael?
Yes, I understand. But why do you have to go, Mom?
Somebody has to go. Mr. Jenkins might be in trouble down there.
Do you have your gun? So you can shoot them if you have to?
Yes, I'll take my gun. Just listen to Mrs. Jenkins and do what she says unless... unless what she says doesn't sound right. Do you understand what I mean, Michael?
I think I do. If she tells me to do something dumb, I shouldn't do it, right?
Right. But think. Just think. And otherwise, do what she says. Now take care of Annie. Remember, you're the man.
What's all that shooting, Rourke?
Either Mexicans trying to get across the border into here, which would be damn foolish just now, or Americans trying to get across into Mexico, which would be just the reverse of the usual situation, wouldn't it? Wasp wetbacks.
You were right about this place. Everything looks like it's been looted 50 times.
That's something to do, I guess. Quiet a minute.
What is it?
Shh. Sounds like a riot, maybe. Some kind of mob heading toward us.
Women? Kids? Are they nuts?
Maybe desperate's a better word. Let's get out of here. We can't go back the way we came. Look, either another mob or part of the same one.
But there's a gunfight down the other way by the border.
Maybe they won't notice us.
Is this what's left of the world? My God.
It may sound like some kind of put-on, but I expected worse. And don't worry who you shoot at. They'll all be shooting at us. Let's ride.
Rourke and Rubenstein were in a gauntlet of armed men. On one side stood the wreckage of a blown-out bridge. Dozens of Mexicans stood atop it and beneath it, behind heavy concrete columns, firing at an adjacent group of Texans from what must have been the Juarez side of the border. A man from the Mexican group started running into the street toward Rourke, carrying what Rourke identified as a vintage Thompson SMG in his hands, spitting fire. The subgunner fell forward, the body vaulting toward the front wheel of Rourke's bike. Rourke lifted the CAR-15 to waist level and pointed it towards the crowd of Texans, many of whom seemed to be quickly losing interest in the Mexicans atop the bridge. Hang on, John! Rourke pulled himself to his feet and ran toward his bike. He spotted two Texans with riot shotguns already en route to the cycle. For the men, Rourke's bike and weapons would be a pretty good haul for a day's work. John dropped to one knee. Rourke rose to his feet, Colt Python in hand, and slung a CAR-15 from its black web sling as he ran towards his bike. Already, more than a half dozen men from the building side of the street were running towards Rourke, assault rifles and pistols clutched in their hands. Rourke cut back along the street, catching sight of Rubenstein coming up fast behind him. The bike jumped the curb, heading down along the sidewalk, parting the Mexicans beneath the bridge in waves before him as he bent low over his bike.
Kid's really getting into it.
Sarah Rourke checked the safety on the AR-15 and pulled the bandana down a little over her ears. When she had left the campsite, she had half thought of taking her horse as a quick means of escape. She knew it wouldn't have been worth it, though. The noise the animal would make might give her away, and it probably wouldn't have sped her much in any case, given the thick brush. Sarah dropped to the ground, hugging the AR-15 to her chest. She was less than 50 yards from the edge of the town now, and could see into the street clearly. A half dozen members of the gang stood in a circle with Ron Jenkins at the center, tied with thick ropes to a pickup truck. One of the men, a tall black man with no sleeves on his coat, had a jumper cable connected to the vehicle in his gloved right hand, the cable leading to a storage battery on the ground a few inches from Ron Jenkins' feet. Sarah Rourke looked carefully on each side of the center of the street and saw no one, just the four men and two women torturing Ron Jenkins. One of the men was black, as was one of the women. There was another pickup truck parked a few yards away from the one to which Ron Jenkins was lashed, but it appeared empty to her. She got up to her knees, then rose to her feet, the rifle snug to her shoulder.
Don't move, any of you. I've got you covered with an automatic rifle. Now step away from him.
Well, well. We caught your sign earlier. Figured if we grabbed your man here, you'd soon come to get him. You can have him, too. All we want is your horses. And maybe something else now that I think about it. He don't look like much for a girl like you. Sweet thing. Now give me that gun before I whoop your ass for trying to scare me. You hear?
I'll give you a part of it.
Sarah hit the female occupant of a pickup truck and one of the men as he tried climbing into the truck's cab. She picked off another of the men with a shot to the head as he jumped into the back of the pickup. A man was running to catch the vehicle driven by the last gang member. Sarah had drawn a 3-point bullet line across the man's chest as the truck sped away. She reloaded on the run as she ran to Jenkins' side.
Ron! Ron, it's all right. I'll get you out of this.
I'm not gonna make it, sir. Take care of Carla and Millie. Get them to Mount Eagle. Oh, God. God bless you. Because them killers is gonna be back here. Sure as...
It sure as taxes and death.